we're on such high carb diets, especially bread, rice, donuts, that it's driving what was meant to be a survival mechanism has converted into what's driving metabolic diseases.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter. Welcome again to our program, The Empowering Neurologist. Today, we're going to take a deep dive into metabolism, into really what is so central to so many of the illnesses of modern times, like obesity, diabetes, some forms of cancer, and yes, even Alzheimer's disease. These are issues related to problems with our metabolism. We'll be talking with Dr. Richard Johnson. Many of you can recall that he has been on the program a couple of times in the past, really centered on our discussions about uric acid. Today, we're going to be talking more about metabolism as it relates to ideas like GLP-1 drugs, like Ozempic, for example. We'll be talking about allulose as a sugar substitute, a sweetener that's become very popular, and that is a sweetener that does have some GLP-1 agonist activity. I'm looking forward to our interview. There's so much to learn always from Dr. Johnson. It's why he's coming back for his third visit on The Empowered Neurologist. Let's jump right in. Well, hello, Dr. Johnson. Welcome back from Dubai.
Thank you, David. It's really great to be back on your show. I'm delighted to be here today.
So that our audience knows, we're doing a fair amount of interaction on all kinds of platforms, one of which is Alzheimer's Prevention Day that we're working on. I think, with our frustration of the notion of Alzheimer's awareness being enough, but so we're getting to see each other quite a bit, which is great. But I wanted to, and I mentioned this to you prior to going on a recording, that you just came back from Dubai, the COP28 conference. So first of all, how does a guy like you end up being so interested in the environment?
Well, first off, it's great seeing you, David. And it's true, we are collaborating on so many subjects, and it's been wonderful. So the international climate meetings are held once a year. And although these COP meetings are often focused on policies, there has been a movement to look at the effects on health and to bring physicians to these meetings. I have been doing, as you know, a lot of research in general. Most of it's been on sugar and obesity and uric acid, but I actually have a research focus as well on climate change and how it can affect kidney disease. And there's a very big epidemic of chronic kidney disease that was discovered in Central America. There's been like 60,000 deaths. And it's also in India and Sri Lanka. And there's also some going on in Mexico. And I've been very actively involved in this epidemic going back to 2012. We were the first ones to link it with climate change. We've also linked it with toxins from cutting. It's often seen in sugarcane workers, and the toxins are related to the burning of the sugarcane fields, which they do before they harvest it. And so I've been actively involved in this. And with that, I got involved with a foundation called the Climate and Health Foundation. And I went to this meeting because this was one of the very first COPs that actually devoted, more than a day to climate and health. And I think what's being recognized is we used to think of climate change and global warming as something that's going to threaten us in the future. But what's happening is we're actually seeing a lot of people suffering from climate-related things even now. And as a kind of a leader in medicine looking at this, I decided to go to this meeting. I did give a presentation, and it was a very, very beneficial meeting. So that's why I was there.
Well, we've been doing a pretty deep dive over the past couple of years into the area of specifically particulate pollution, these so-called PM2.5s and their role in neurodegenerative conditions. I mean, the literature came out about 10 years ago looking at showing relationships of PM2.5 exposure to dementia risk. And more recently, as in last week, published in the journal Neurology, a relationship between 2.5 PM2.5 exposure and Parkinson's risk. So, you know, I think there are multiple mechanisms that we could unpack, but I think certainly inflammation is one of them. I think that as it relates to these PM2.5s, it's reasonable to ask the question, okay, what exactly are these particles? And you know, as it relates, for example, to the increased rate of forest fires that we're seeing globally and our exposure to this type of smoke, that yes, we're breathing in forest smoke, but and I think it's important for people to get their arms around the fact that cities are burning. This past summer in Canada, in northern Canada, everybody says, well, it's a forest fire. And it's being, you know, you have this notion that, well, the smoke is sitting around the campfire. What could be wrong with that? But it's buildings. It's, you know, there's a lot of things being thrown in the atmosphere that are really toxic. And in my world, as it relates to the brain, this is something that, at least in our literature, we're seeing appear more and more frequently, and I think with good reason, and especially, you know, important for us because we can talk about what is the context of our modern world in terms of what we can do about it. Yes, from a climate change perspective, that's for sure, but also what we can do to protect people in terms of, you know, assessing and improving the quality of their indoor air. People spend 90% of their time these days indoors. What can we be doing? And I think it's a clear and present danger that's not getting much attention.
You are right on the money. And just to follow up on this, you know, what they were doing in these areas was to burn the sugarcane fields. And also, like in Sri Lanka, they'll burn the rice paddies for fertilization at the end. And it turns out that these sugarcane and rice have a lot of silica in their plant. And when you burn this silica turns out to be about 70% of the PM2.5. And if you give sugarcane ash to animals and like laboratory rats, and we did that, we gave it through the nose into the lung, as well as we've given it orally. And what happens is that the sugarcane ash has these silica nanoparticles, which actually adhere chemicals like agrochemicals as well. And these particles, the nanoparticles, get through the body. This crystalline silica can cause a disease called silicosis. That's what you get with construction workers. But in this fine smoke, the PM2.5 consists of nanoparticles, which are smaller, and they pass into the system. We find them in the lung, in the liver, in the spleen, and in the kidney. We haven't looked at the brain. David, I need to do this with you, actually. But we recently did kidney biopsies on these patients that are developing this terrible kidney disease, and we found silica nanoparticles in their kidneys. And when we give silica to animals, they start getting kidney disease too. So we do think that that's playing a role, and the PM2.5 is really the key player. And PM2.5 is also associated with metabolic diseases and neurologic diseases, as you say. So it's really an important thing to consider. And this is an environmental problem on top of the heat stress and all that. And we think that the heat actually increases the permeability in the gut to absorb these toxins. So heat stress makes you more, and also in the lung, increases the ability of these toxins to get into the circulation.
So yes, with the heat stress being a threat in and of itself as well.
Right. You're right. And so we could create chronic kidney disease with repeated heat stress, but we're now doing studies to look at what we call the synergy of these pathways. Yeah, as we eventually control metabolic diseases, these environmental and toxin and climate diseases are going to start to manifest more.
Well, that was an optimistic statement, just then. As we ultimately control metabolic diseases, that's the preface there. I like that. I mean, that makes me feel good. We're doing the right thing.
I think we're going the right direction, but it is it's getting close to Christmas, and we're going to be talking about sugar today. Santa's not going to be happy, but I'm
telling you, it's not just the message, but the messenger. I think, respectfully, Santa might be a little bit metabolically dysfunctional. If you, all due respect, I mean,
if he had a keto diet, he could get down the chimney faster.
Yeah, but you think back about his origin, what company actually brought him into being? We'll leave that for another day.
Yeah.
But just one more thing is related to climate change. You know, most of the interest, I think, over the years has focused on the changes in latitudes with respect to infectious disease. You know, we've started to see what were more tropical types of diseases spreading into Florida and then further north, arthropod-borne types of things like chikungunya, dengue, et cetera. And, you know, there's been the concern that these are diseases that we wouldn't see at more central and even northern latitudes. And as the world warms, we're going to see that. People are not prepared for that. I think that the PM2.5 and pollution in general is going to turn out to be a far more pervasive issue the way it spreads. I mean, this past summer, we watched these wildfires in northeastern Canada, and the experience was felt throughout the United States and to some degree measurable, at least in Europe. So, you know, we share a pretty small space. And when we start to aggressively befoul our own nest, then, there are consequences to pay. We spend some time, as I've told you before, in the Pacific Northwest on a boat in the summertime. And the truth of the matter is we had to close up and be underway in this beautiful, pristine Pacific Northwest with windows closed and a HEPA air filter on and not even able to navigate in during a beautiful day unless we had radar on because of the thickness of
Wow,
the snow.
That's scary.
I mean, that.
I believe that we need, as scientists and researchers and clinicians, we need to view the environmental and climate associated conditions and diseases that are occurring as a high priority. And that's why I went to COP. That's why I have grants on climate change and kidney disease and climate change and its effects on metabolism. It also increases the risk for obesity. You know, it gets hotter, people drink more soft drinks. But actually, we've been able to show that heat stress activates some of the same processes that are driving metabolic disease. So it's part and parcel of what we have to do. And I'm so delighted that you are also so focused on this. We have a lot more in common, David, than we are even aware.
We haven't played guitar together yet, but
I would love to do that with you.
The role of these PM2.5s in amping up inflammation in the body, I think, has some behavioral downstream effects in that we know that inflammation tends to restrict the top-down control in terms of decision-making from the prefrontal cortex that normally would temper a decision-making being made with the influence of the amygdala. In other words, impulsivity, not thinking about consequences, future effects of our decisions. In other words, the more inflammation we are exposed to, the less able we are to make better decisions. And I say that because you brought up an interesting topic, and that is the idea that the hotter the environment, the more soft drinks people are going to be drinking. But in addition, you know, the more inflammation that we experience, the less able we are to say no to those bad decisions, and the more likely we are to engage in those inappropriate food choices, which further then augments inflammation and further segregates our decision-making towards, you know, takes the adult out of the room.
Yeah, we've even done experimental studies with heat stress and dehydration. And when you do that, it actually also enhances the production of fructose in the body because it activates pathways that are involved in sugar production. And so, as you and I know, sugar contains glucose and fructose bound together, and high fructose corn syrup is another type of mixture of glucose and fructose. And the vast majority of the sugar we're eating, the sugar and high fructose corn syrup, that makes up a major source of fructose that we get. And fructose, as you know, has been my the baby that I've been studying for years and seems to be involved in metabolic disease. But when you do heat stress and dehydration, it will activate pathways that will stimulate the conversion of glucose to fructose in the body. And when that happens, you can actually see metabolic changes, like even fatty liver, start to develop.
Well, it brings up an interesting topic, and that is the survival mechanisms that are activated in the brain that actually, you know, really kind of depend on this polyol pathway for the conversion of glucose into fructose, and then the downstream generation of uric acid being pro-inflammatory and allowing or really causing us to take more risks in life. And therefore, maybe that's a survival pathway. It's what you and I wrote a paper about.
Absolutely. And also, you've become a world expert on uric acid yourself. And, you know, it's very interesting. There's a group at the National Institute of Health that actually did some studies where they raised uric acid in animals. And just by raising uric acid in animals genetically, these animals became very impulsive. And they started, actually, they also increased their locomotor activity, like they were foraging, and they would actually jump more initially. Although in the long term, it's not so good. In the short term, it was made them hyperactive. That's not necessarily good either. So it's really true.
What you and I kind of focused on the past few years has been kind of the biochemistry changes, the physiological changes that happen to pave the way for survival in our primate ancestors because of elevated uric acid, you know, the mitochondrial down functionality, down regulation, less energy consumption, lipogenesis, gluconeogenesis, raising blood pressure, effects on fluid dynamics, et cetera. We've talked about that in our books, for example, and certainly on podcasts, et cetera. But I think that you and I need to do a little bit more work on the behavioral aspects, like you just alluded to, in that you've noticed in animals that we talked that in the paper that we wrote, we talked about might have been also a powerful survival mechanism, that when you're impulsive and you take a lot of risks, maybe, you know, being less careful is a good thing, that you might find food by, you know, traversing an area that's dangerous, whereas somebody more conservative with less uric acid might not feel they need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you are alluding to, there was a period of time 15 million years ago when our ancestors were actually going through a period of global cooling, and there was a loss of food habitats. They were mainly eating fruit, and they started starving. You could actually see that because it was seasonal starvation. When it was the cooler part of the year, there weren't fruit available, and they would actually start to starve, and you could see that from changes in their teeth, actually. They had that mutation that involved uric acid, and their serum uric acid went up. And we actually did studies where we resurrected the extinct gene and did all these cool studies. And what we were able to show is that when they had this mutation, it helped them significantly to store fat and also to forage. And just as you're saying, foraging involves being impulsive. It involves all the things you say about going into a dangerous area, moving fast. You got to look around quickly. You can't focus on anything for any particular period of time because you just have to keep moving. And, you know, acutely, this is a survival tool that's really helpful. There's no food around. The guy you want that the bravest in the group, the one who's the most impulsive and the fastest to go out there and find the food as rapidly as they can. But, you know, if you do that chronically, it can be associated with diseases like ADHD. And there's studies in children with ADHD, and they have higher uric acid levels than children the same age that don't have ADHD. So this is, you know, this is pretty important because sugar raises uric acid. And other things do too, but sugar is a major, major stimulus of uric acid. And so, you know, when people eat a lot of sugar, they actually, it's not uncommon for parents to say that they're hyperactive. You know, we can go into that more. But basically, I think there's a great area for you and I to investigate more.
Sure. And I would say, we're going to need to jump back from the middle Miocene period to current metabolic mayhem.
Yes.
I want to tell you one thing. I always prepare for a podcast by writing out a bunch of questions that I think I'm going to ask the guest, and I post them here in front of me so I can, steer the conversation. And I will say, interestingly, that ChatGPT has been helping me write those questions as of late. Wow. But I didn't write a single question for today, and we haven't even started. So that should tell us something. We're going to be talking about metabolism, about sugar, about allulose sugar. We'll be talking about GLP-1, how the agonists work, et cetera. We've got some ground to cover. You were kind enough to provide us some slides, so I'm going to turn to those slides right now.
Thank you. So these are some slides that we prepared for today. And I first want to just briefly remind everyone about fructose and why we're interested in it and why this led to my interest in allulose. So first off, everyone I think knows that the classical thinking of what causes obesity is that we eat too much, we exercise too little. And so what happens is when you eat, you're getting calories or energy. And when you exercise, you're burning energy. And if you eat more than you get rid of, it has to go somewhere, so it gets stored as fat. Next slide. Thank you. And so this is the classic thinking. On the left side of the slide, you'll see this. You know, eat too much, exercise too little, excess calories. We fill the tank, with the energy that we're actively using. And then what's excess is stored as fat. But that isn't actually how it works. This, if you look at this classical thinking model, what happens is you're filling up the gas tank, and then the leftover goes into fat. But the way it actually is working is that there's a break done where you don't actually fill up the gas tank. The gas tank stays on a low power or half full. And so the way it works is that there's one food that does this. Is one major nutrient that switches the gas to go half full, and that is fructose. And when you eat foods that contain fructose, which is basically sugar and high fructose corn syrup, or that produce fructose, and fructose is only produced from carbs. So when you're eating particularly high glycemic carbs like bread, rice, and potatoes, they can be converted to fructose in the body. But whichever way you get it, if you make it or you eat it, that fructose, when it's metabolized, generates uric acid. The mean guy, the bad guy that David and I talk about. And that uric acid goes to the mitochondria. And the mitochondria are the energy factories. That's where the energy is made. The active energy is made. It's called ATP. And the uric acid suppresses the production of energy. And when it does that, it shakes that gas tank and drops it to 2/3. It doesn't drop it to near empty. It just drops the gas down to enough that it makes you worry that that you don't have enough energy, that you're at risk of running out. And that triggers a whole host of biochemical reactions that try to say, we want to fill that tank of gas. And that means I have to eat. So you start getting hungry and thirsty. You start searching for foods. And then you also block satiety. You block that feeling of fullness. So you go into a hungry caterpillar effect where you just keep eating and eating. And that's what drives weight gain. And so it's actually, and because it won't go to the ATP because it's being suppressed, the energy has to go to fat. That's the only, that's the stored site. So basically, it keeps active energy down and stimulates the storage of fat. But there are also effects that are activated independently of calories. And those calorie-independent effects are what drives diabetes and metabolic effects, high blood pressure, and even brain effects. So you're gaining weight because you're eating more but you have metabolic effects that can occur even if you've activated this switch. You can become diabetic even without eating a lot, you know, even like being on a caloric restriction.
So basically, in the upper right, sugar is telling your body that you're starving, and it's putting into play these mechanisms to keep you alive, to make fat, to reduce your mitochondrial function so you're not burning, not using energy, and you're storing fat, even though, you know, that's inappropriate. And I would say that, you know, these metabolic effects on the bottom right of the screen, diabetes, hypertension, dementia, that, you know, we see the research that clearly correlates the consumption of fructose-containing beverages, even fruit juice, as well as certainly soft drinks, with cognitive decline, with risk, rather, for dementia. And what a, you know, those aren't very many dots to connect. Eat a lot of fructose, you raise your risk of dementia. It's a pretty powerful message. Well, hi, everyone. Dr. David Perlmutter here. We hope you're enjoying this content. And if you would do so, go ahead and hit the like button. And if you're not already a subscriber to our channel, please consider doing so. We're really grateful to have you as part of our community. So let's get right back to the presentation.
Yes, it's very powerful. So the question is, why would there be a system to make us fat and to create all these metabolic effects? And next slide. And it turns out that it was because there are times when animals want to get fat. And that's, you know, for example, like a bear that's going to hibernate in the winter because there's no food around needs to have sufficient fat stores to get through the winter. And so what happens is in the fall, when the fruit ripens, the animals will eat huge amounts of fruit. I mean like 10,000 grapes in a day, nothing like we do. Okay. This is like large amounts of fruit. And when they do that, they trigger this fructose switch and they turn their mitochondria down. They make less ATP and they eat more, but now the calories, instead of going to make ATP, are actually going right into fat, and it's to help the animal. And they become insulin resistant, which means that their glucose instead of going into the muscle, stays up in the circulation. And that can allow the brain, for the areas of the brain that don't use insulin, that glucose can be used there. And so this was all meant to be a survival pathway. And in the short term, you know, it stimulates foraging. This helps survival. And so the fructose sort of developed as a nutrient to help animals prepare for when things are in trouble, or, you know, so you can get that fat before you actually get into trouble. And so it's like triggered by eating a lot of fruit in the fall before winter, and a lot of animals do it. You know, lemurs will eat a lot of fruit to gain fat to help them through the dry season. And when they hibernate, even in hot weather, it's called estivation. And then they break down the fat to make calories and water, because when you break down fat, you get water. So it's sort of interesting. So this was meant to be a good thing. Next slide. And so we actually found ways to activate this switch ourselves. We even found ways to amplify it with this mutation that occurred millions of years ago. So we are very sensitive to sugar. And if you give like sugar to a mouse, you have to give a large amount of sugar to get an effect. But to humans, we are very sensitive because of all these things that have happened to us. But look what happened. Once we learned, you know, how to make sugar, instead of eating 4 pounds a year, which is what we did in 1700, now we can eat 150 pounds or more of sugar. And so we're eating huge amounts of sugar and high fructose corn syrup. We have been able to reduce that a little bit in the last decade, but we're still eating so much that it makes up 15 to 20% of our diet. And that's enough to basically make all of us at high risk for metabolic syndrome, for, you know, for having high insulin levels chronically, for getting overweight. This is why so many people in our culture are overweight or obese are about to become overweight or obese. Okay, we can go to the next slide. So what's happened now is that because we're eating a lot of sugar, plus we're eating a lot of carbs, and the high glycemic carbs, as I mentioned, also can be converted to fructose in the body. And in fact, they may be even more dangerous than sugar under certain circumstances. And so when we're on such high carb diets, especially bread, rice, donuts, that it's driving what was meant to be a survival mechanism has converted into what's driving metabolic diseases. And we can go around this from the left to the go clockwise, and you know causes hunger, craving, fat storage and obesity, diabetes, heart disease and systemic inflammation. It raises blood pressure. That was meant to improve our circulation and maintain the circulation. But now it's when it becomes high blood pressure, it's actually damaging blood vessels in the brain. And also when it suppresses those mitochondria, it reduces the oxygen that's being used by the animal, because a lot of oxygen is used to make ATP. And so when you block that or reduce it, it actually leads to kind of a low oxygen survival. You can survive with low oxygen. And this pathway is associated with what we call the Warburg effect, where you can what's called glycolysis. And it's been found to drive cancers. And if you give fructose and put it on cancer cells, they grow like mad. And if you raise uric acid, the cancers can spread very quickly. We've published on this. And it turns out that this is another bad consequence of this. The cancers that are seen in people with obesity are probably largely linked with these pathways. So anyway, so next slide. So this was just a kind of an overview. And of course, when you hear this, people say, well, what? Fructose is in fruit. Does that mean we can't eat fruit? No, you should eat natural fruits, whole fruits. You don't want to drink fruit juice, because there you're concentrating a lot of fruits and you're getting a lot of fructose, and it's bad. But if you're eating an occasional fruit, you can see here that there's much less fructose or sugar in fruit compared to a soft drink. And so there's much less fructose exposure. And then you have all those wonderful benefits from fruit. Fruit contains vitamin C. Flavanols, that quercetin, for example, can be found in apples, and that's a beautiful flavanol. There's one called epicatechin. Fiber, potassium, all these things actually help counter the effects of fructose. But as the fruit ripens, those things tend to go down, and the sugar content goes up. So when the fruit falls out of the tree and it's really ripe and mushy, a lot of animals will like it because it's very high in sugar. But thankfully, humans prefer a little bit more tart fruit that often has some of these vitamin C and so forth in it. So everything that David has told you is exactly what we're also finding in our research studies. You know, we need to cut back on carbs and sugar and gluten and bread and rice and potatoes. Low-carb diets, Mediterranean diets, intermittent fasting, all these keto diets, they're all quite good. Olive oil and omega-3 tend to counter these effects. So everything you've been learning about is pretty much the same based on our work as well. And, you know, you shouldn't – salt is – if you're on a low-carb diet, salt's actually beneficial because you're on a low carb diet, and the salt's not really, doing anything bad. It's actually probably good. But when you eat salted French fries, the salt actually will stimulate the conversion of the potato starch to fructose. And so salt enhances fructose production. So, and processed foods where they put a lot of salt and sugar, it's really a double whammy. And then you know, increase your water intake. That is a very important thing, getting good sleep, getting regular sleep, and not exercising. I mean, exercising regularly is good. So, but what about artificial sugars? And I think this is the big thing that we wanted to talk about today. David, do you want to say anything at this point, or do you want me to keep
I think I'll let you finish off here, and then we'll talk about, I've been making notes, so we'll talk about a few things.
Okay, great. Yes, feel free to jump in anytime. Okay, so now we're going to go to this whole thing about what about low-calorie sugars? And I will preface this by saying that, you know, most of my research has been in fructose, but I have done some studies on low-calorie sugars, and so I'll try to point out what I've learned and what I've read. And so, you know, we can break up low-calorie sugars into artificial sweeteners, sugar alcohols, natural sweeteners, and natural rare sugars. And each of these have their own large group of compounds, but some of the more common ones are shown here on this slide. Now, there are benefits of all low-calorie substitutes for sugar, because if you, let's say you're drinking a soft drink that's got 35 grams of sugar in it, that is going to activate millions of bad things. It's going to cause inflammation, raise your uric acid. It's going to do all those terrible things. And if you drink a diet soft drink, you're not going to get those bad things are not going to happen anywhere near the same. It's black and white. And if you do a clinical trial of soft drinks versus diet soft drinks, the diet soft drinks always win, basically, in a paired study, a carefully done study. And that's because the sugar in high fructose corn syrup not only contain calories, but they contain fructose that activates those bad things. So, you know, there is some advantage to low-calorie drinks, just in general, low-calorie. Of course, it would be better to drink water. It would be better to avoid artificial sugars if you can. But if you've got that if you have a craving for sweetness, maybe eat a fruit first. But there is this argument that when compared head to head, there's definitely an advantage to taking a low-calorie sugar. So if someone says which is worse, it's the sugar that's worse. And that's because they don't activate the fructose switch. There are some exceptions. There are some artificial sugars like sorbitol, which if you absorb it, not everyone absorbs it as much as others, but some people absorb it quite well. And it's like the artificial sugar it's a sugar alcohol that's actually put in syrups, and it will convert to fructose in your body. So that's not a good one. But there are a lot of disadvantages to low-calorie sugars too, okay? And one thing with all these artificial sugars and low-calorie sugars is that because they're sweet, they don't really teach you away from liking sweet. You know, we have sweet taste buds. We love sweets. When you eat sugar or anything sweet, you get a dopamine response in the brain, which is this pleasure response, and you get it with both low-calorie sugars as well as regular sugars. It's interesting. We did studies, and others have done this as well. If you knock out the taste receptor so you can't taste sweet, you still get a dopamine response in the brain to fructose, but you don't get a dopamine response to these low-calorie sugars. So the low-calorie sugars are working through the taste buds, but the to give you that pleasure response. But fructose is driving the desire for it through its effects on the brain, through its metabolism, not just through its taste. All right. So it will maintain when you take a low calorie sugar, you will, you're not going to get rid of your liking for sweets, but it's pretty hard to get rid of your liking for sweets. And almost all of us, even if you go on a, diets, you know, we, so long as you got those taste buds with the sweet taste bud, every now and then that craving for sweets will haunt people. And I know Ben Bickman was on your show the other day, and he often talks about how at night, you know, after dinner, I'll have this kind of desire for something sweet. And so, but having these low calorie sugars will continue to stimulate that pathway. Now, some low sugar, low calorie sugars also can induce insulin resistance. It was really the big one is saccharin. And we actually confirmed it. It's actually a microbiome effect. Saccharin, it's hard to make an animal fat by giving it saccharin. There may be one or two reports, but we certainly never saw it ourselves in the lab. But it can cause a little bit of insulin resistance, and it's working through a funny way through the microbiome. And some sweeteners have been associated with cancer risk, especially saccharin. And some have been associated with cardiovascular risk, like erythritol. And things like aspartame, there's some thoughts that it might actually lead to some trouble with cognition. And certainly that's frightening. And I'd be very interested in your thoughts about aspartame and its effects on the brain.
We'll talk about it when we finish the slide presentation.
Okay. All right, good. So anyway, so there are benefits and disadvantages with using low-calorie sugars. But in general, none of these low-calorie sugars have ever been really shown to have a benefit. They just don't have a harm. They are safer than high-fructose corn syrup, but they by themselves are not really causing weight loss. And that is until this new sugar came, allulose. And a quick disclaimer, when I started studying and learning about allulose, I realized that it was very relevant to my research. And I was approached by a company, RX Sugar, to consider joining them as a scientific officer. And so I recently did that in addition to having my position at the university. So that's just a quick disclaimer. But I did it because of what I'm about to show you. This is why I'm interested. So allulose turns out to be a natural sugar. So when it's out there in nature, everyone's eating a little bit of it. It's in fruits and wheat and a variety of different things. But basically, we're all eating small amounts of it. But someone figured out that if they made a lot of it, that it could be a low-calorie sugar alternative. And it's got very, very minimal calories, but it's still sweet. And interestingly, it looks just like fructose. I know that many of you are not chemists, so this looks like gobbledygook. But basically, the two are almost identical, except for some very minor change in the direction a hydroxy group goes. And that turns out to be a big thing because it doesn't activate that biologic switch. It doesn't generate uric acid. It doesn't cause the suppression of the mitochondria. And so it's like an empty gun when it comes to fructose. It looks like fructose. It's sweet, not quite as sweet as fructose, but it's sweet, but it doesn't activate this biologic switch. And when we start looking at it, it actually seems to do good things. This is why I got interested, because it tends to lower glucose. And it is this is a very profound effect. If you, for example, if you eat bread or rice with some allulose, you won't get that rise in glucose following the ingestion. I mean, it will blunt it dramatically. And it is very, very consistent. And this is good because that rise in blood glucose can be converted to fructose. It also stimulates insulin. And I mean, it turns out that when the glucose goes up in your blood, it's not good. That's why we say insulin resistance is not good, because high blood glucose and high insulin levels is what we know plays a major role in causing things like dementia, obesity, and so forth. So for this to block that is just really exciting. And that is the main reason I joined the company, because I wanted to understand this sugar, how it's working. Why is it that this guy's such a good guy? The other thing is there is now absolute data showing that it stimulates a hormone called GLP-1. GLP-1 is a hormone that's released. It's released after you eat food, and particularly glucose, and it goes into the blood, and it communicates with the brain, and it actually, has all kinds of biologic effects, including to kind of say that you're full. It slows the gut, the gastric motility to say you're full. It tends to keep glucose levels down. And one of the ways it does it is it enhances glucose uptake in the liver and in the muscle, where it can actually be used for good things, and keeps the glucose levels relatively low in the blood. So some of that glucose benefit of allulose may be from the stimulation of this GLP-1. Well, the reason that's so interesting is that, as anyone knows who's been connected to the world, that there are these new drugs that are being used for obesity. And these new drugs are GLP-1. They look like GLP-1, they act like GLP-1, but they're not actually GLP-1, but they've been manipulated to have long half-lives. And so when you take them, they have half-lives like where the blood levels are elevated for a whole week, whereas normally they're not, they're only high for minutes after you eat. And so when it's high all the time, remember how I told you it slows motility in the gut, and it stimulates satiety, or the feeling of fullness. So these drugs have been found to make people feel full, and they eat less, and they eat less and less. It can become a problem. They can actually eat so little that they're not getting the nutrients they're needing, or they can get gastric motility issues where they get a lot of side effects, but they do lose weight. But here, allulose is stimulating the same hormone, but it's a natural stimulation of the hormone, as opposed to taking an artificial one that's elevated all the time. So this enhances it for hours, or at least for at least a couple hours after you eat. And that it has been associated in animal studies with blocking weight gain. And so, I want to do a study in humans, a really good one, to see if this can be something similar to semaglutide or Ozempic. And instead of having to, to take drugs, you can take a chocolate that has allulose and maybe get some benefits. And so, I mean, we don't know how what the right dose is, and I've got to do more work on this, but it's looking very, very positive. And the other thing is, like, by putting glucose in the muscle, it seems to, in animals, it improves their exercise performance. It's anti-aging. It can improve cognition in some studies in animals. So it's looking like a good guy. So when you look at low calorie sugars, we're looking at them as being neutral. They're not bad like sugar or high fructose corn syrup, but they're not positive. They're not like creating benefit. But here I'm excited because here's a low calorie sugar that might actually improve exercise tolerance and things like that. So that's why I'm interested in it. This is just showing an example. This is a clinical study where they gave sugar or sucrose. Sucrose is table sugar. And if you look, there's a box measuring. I mean, this is a graph showing the plasma glucose after you get a slug of sugar. And it goes up to like three millimoles, which is that's like going up the equivalent of like 70 milligrams per deciliter of blood. And it's blocked in half by co-administering only a half dose of allulose, and allulose alone doesn't raise blood sugar at all. So this, it's pretty convincing. There's lots of evidence for this in humans. It's very true with even small doses. So there's a clear benefit. Next slide.
Well, I just want to, for one moment, take a closer look at this. In other words, eating sugar pops or sucrose really pops your postprandial glucose quickly there at the 30-minute mark. But if co-administered with allulose, another sweetener that people are consuming, then that rise in the blood sugar is dramatically blunted. That's the circles, the filled in black circles, consuming the sugar, and yet with the allulose, you don't get that huge postprandial glucose rise. That's so important.
Yeah, that's so important because you and I have are recognizing that this rise in glucose is actually a major risk factor for things like dementia. And there's some studies showing that when the blood glucose goes up, the brain starts making fructose. And we know that that has a role in dementia. So, you know, this looks good. So, yeah, next slide. And this is the study showing that it stimulates GLP. And, you know, the usual substance that people use to raise GLP is like glucose. This is measuring it in a mouse. So it's a mouse on the left side. But as you increase the allulose dose or concentration, you get a dramatic increase in GLP-1 that you can measure in the portal vein. And that you don't really see that for the same doses of glucose. So it turns out that allulose is about 8 to 10 times more potent at stimulating GLP-1. And GLP-1 is this drug or hormone that makes you full. So, you know, a lot of people who take allulose, you know, anecdotally, talk about how they feel full afterwards. And I know I took some with my wife one day. Well, we are eating it more than that. But when we find that it does suppress our appetite. So like if you eat it like at lunch, after lunch, right at the end of lunch, you may end up having a dinner where you get full with just like 2/3 of the food. And so this has been associated with the weight loss. This 2 grams of allulose on the right graph, that's very little allulose. That's like a thumbnail, and yet it's causing some weight loss in people over a 10-week period. And they're taking this with sugar. It's amazing. So, so anyway, so I want to study it. I want to understand it. I'm not telling you all to go out and get it for sure, but I do think that it's it looks very, very interesting, very promising, and they're already.
Well, thank you for that.
Yes, well, you have been a wonderful collaborator. We, as many of you may not know, David and I wrote a paper on Alzheimer's disease and fructose together, and of course we've been reading each other's stuff and are connected quite a lot. So good.
So that's a fascinating description of, you know, where we are, what's the leading edge here on allulose. And I would just also want to say that I serve as a scientific advisor as well for RX Sugar. And I'm glad to be part of that. I mean, as you know, we get to explore some really good science with the collaborators who are doing some just amazing work. And, you know, I look upon this, I think, as you do, that this is really a game changer and will have global implications. I mean, you know, face it, there's a big issue with these metabolic problems globally now. We used to call it the standard American diet, then it became the Western diet. But call it like it is, it's the global diet that's so high in these ultra-processed foods that raise blood sugar. About 52 to 54% of all calories consumed by an American adult right now are derived from ultra-processed foods, which they raise blood sugar. And now we're looking at a sweetener that's looking like it's blunting that. And a couple of points I want to make. First, you know, this is to understand this is one and how it might affect you as an observer, the audience, it really is, I think, a call to reconsider this notion of wearing a continuous glucose monitor. As you know, I've been talking about that for quite some time. And if you were to wear a CGM, you'd be able to visualize in real time these changes that are going on with your blood sugar in response to a meal or exercise or lack of sleep the night before, et cetera, and then be able to see how something like allulose, for example, might change the playing field a little bit and blunt that glucose response that you might otherwise have noted. I want to get back to a couple ideas. You mentioned quercetin earlier on in the discussion, and I think that you've also mentioned quercetin in the context of assisting the body in reducing the formation of uric acid, along with luteolin. And you know, one thing I think that's really kind of interesting is the role of quercetin, if someone were to supplement with that, as something that simulates UCP1 or uncoupling protein 1, which is kind of a player as relates to this process of mitophagy, which we need to break down defective mitochondria in order that we might engage what's called mitochondria biogenesis, or the creation of new, healthier mitochondria. So I don't know how you feel about it, but I'm really kind of bullish on quercetin these days.
I think quercetin is a wonderful flavanol that has many benefits, and so does luteolin. We've actually studied luteolin in particular, but quercetin is also one of the best for lowering uric acid. Luteolin also can block fructokinase a little bit, which makes it very interesting. There's one called Ostol. When we give these kinds of compounds to animals, we can actually block a lot of metabolic effects of sugar. And so these flavanols are wonderful. And so I do think that they probably have a place. The one thing we don't know as well is, you know, what's the dose in humans that really works the most effectively. But I'm pro on these as well. And also, I like vitamin C. Vitamin C lowers uric acid. Our group has been studying this. We have some evidence that it's really a very powerful regulator of uric acid as well. And that like 500 milligrams a day can reduce uric acid by about 0.5 milligrams per deciliter, which is, you know, about 10%. In the normal person. I think that vitamin C is also a wonderful a way to go, and the two together are probably better than either one alone.
And there was one study that was done, I think at Oxford, involving young men given 500 milligrams a day of quercetin, lowered over an 8-week period, lowered their uric acid by about 8%, which is certainly reasonable. You know, the other thing that we're, I think, seeing a lot of these days is the research that shows the role of supplemental quercetin in enhancing the production of brown fat and actually the conversion of white fat into brown fat, which obviously means.
I actually take quercetin at
all. So do I. I've had allulose already today as well.
Good for you.
Well, Richard, always great to see you. I think that you are on the top of the leaderboard in terms of repeat appearances on the Empowering Neurologist podcast. So I want to thank you for that, because it's always great information, and I sure appreciate your time.
It's really enjoyable to talk to you and to be on your show. Thank you so
great.
Much.
I'm looking forward. We may see each other next month, depending on travel plans. So I'm looking forward to that. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All I can say is, wow. I mean, Dr. Johnson provides so much information. And now we're learning about this sweetener that we can use, allulose, that actually acts in many ways as a GLP-1 agonist. We're hearing so much about that these days. And really, in our time of metabolic mayhem that we live in, it's nice to know that there are some choices that we can make day in and day out that can help regain better metabolic health for us. And that certainly has a lot of downstream benefits as well. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Dr. David Perlmutter here on the Empowering Neurologist, and we will be back soon. Bye for now.